you know, like they heard this and they got frightened. But the parents, you know, talk about that as a little bit eye-opening. I thought I was creating a really safe and supportive space for my kid. And the fact that it was hard for them to tell me this is really important for me to know. And these parents have gone on to be incredible supporters of their trans kids. They've educated their families. They've gone into schools to educate staff, etc. So, you know, the parents that I've spoken with, the ones who didn't learn right away, they just feel lucky that their kid had the support that they did, that their kid is alive, that they can hug them, that they can feel optimistic about their future. They're grateful to the school.
And you said you look like you want to jump in there. Jay, go ahead.
I want to sort of take it from a teacher's perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because I hear from teachers who are really worried about parents who might have complaints, who mm-hmm. might feel like they're not getting enough information. And one of the things that I found really valuable in helping parents and teachers navigate this is if we can recognize that both the teacher and the parent have the child's best interest as their guiding motivation, that common ground makes it easier to listen to each other. They may have different understandings about what's in the child's best interest, but a belief that both adults or both sets of adults are there to create a caring, nurturing environment for the child is a really helpful starting place for those conversations. I also would say, and I say this as a parent and as an educator, having children is a process of letting go.
I say that to myself all the time.
It's a process of letting go because you're making room for children to be their own people. I have worked with 4- and 5-year-olds in schools who have genders that their parents don't want them to have. And I've seen educators make room for those in brilliant, brilliant ways. And so I think about a kindergarten graduation and the teacher showing up for the photographs and the photographer saying, I've got roses for the girls and ties for the boys. And the teacher thinking, this is not going to work well, and spinning around to the class and saying, class, there's ties and roses. What's going to make you feel most fancy? That's the kind of thing that teachers are doing to create gender-inclusive classrooms. And so when a child comes home with a picture that doesn't look like the parents expected, the parents can come back and say, what happened? And the teacher can say, completely honestly, I gave the children the choice of what's going to make them feel most fancy. Because our job is to celebrate children and to help them feel safe. Creating an understanding that we're both working from the child's best interest helps those conversations happen and makes room to learn and listen to each other in it.
And is there a lack of that kind of understanding between parents? You're nodding at parents.
I'm nodding because I really think there is. Yeah. I think, first of all, I want to challenge who the parents are. And I think there's a perception that parents are heterosexual, that they're white, that they have a particular set of Christian values. And when we're thinking about the parents, that's the imagined parent community. I think a lot of educators feel really limited in what they can do because they're worried about the imagined parent community. And often that's the community because those parents are the loud voices mm-hmm. in a school community. They're not the only ones, but they are the loudest ones. And so we really need to recognize that our parent community includes queer and trans parents, it includes single parents, it includes a whole range of people, it includes multi-generational families, it includes all kinds of structures. And we need to think about how do we hear and make room for all of those families. Because making room for those families makes room for their kids.
Victoria, you talk about representation. How do we hear from those families?
So I definitely think, you know, research such as Travers and Jay, because a lot of the information that we see online is from the point of view of passion legislation or from the point of view of harm. But none of these people have actually talked to trans people, right? It's not like they're saying, well, I've done this research and I've talked to 50 trans people and they say that this is the policy. So I think it's also asking ourselves, why do we have legislation passing laws when the legislation in itself doesn't even represent us identity-wise, but where are they pulling their information from? right? Where are they getting information from? Where are they seeing the danger? Because if you talk to trans people, if you talk to trans kids, like I know today there was a walkout for trans youth, and it was organized by trans youth, right? The teachers didn't tell them this is what you do. So I think there's a lack of actual listening to trans youth. So I definitely think the research that Travers is doing, the research that Jay is doing, I'm doing, gives us more voices. And that's kind of part of my research, is to historicize all of these trans voices so we don't hear things 50 years from now like, in my day, there were no trans people, or this is so different, right? And so I wish there was more talking to trans youth instead of telling them what they are either doing wrong or what's not right. I just wish somebody would say, tell me about you and what you want me to know. And then they will know that the things that we're teaching these children are not harming them, because they're actually talking to them. And I think we don't have enough of actually talking to trans people for us to be making policies about trans people.
And given that it sounds like lack of information, where do you think the backlash and that rhetoric is coming from right now? And why is it happening right now?
I would say a lot of my research looks at the ways in which media pushes a particular type of trans person, or they push a particular type of narrative of, look how much things have changed. So we may look at TV, we may see a lot of these people saying trans people are taking over, or there's so many more trans people now, but trans people are a very, very small part of the population, right? And so we have these repeated images of trans people that makes it seem like they're everywhere, and maybe there's this fear that they're taking over, much in the same way there was a fear that black people were taking over when we got one president. And so I think that people are no longer seeing, and by people, I mean the dominant people may not see themselves as much, so then that maybe they're thinking that there's not a space for me, or if I give space to this individual, I lose space. So it seems like in some ways people are competing for the resource to be seen, when in reality there's space for everyone.
That fear, right? So where is the, how is the rhetoric or you know, these, you talk about organized campaigns, how is that tapping into that fear?
Let me very briefly give a little history. The Christian right was behind anti-gay measures. If anybody remembers Anita Bryant, I'm scarred forever, I don't eat oranges, etc. And they started to fail. I know that in Canada in 2005, same-sex marriage was legalized. And that did create a cultural shift, for sure it did. But when anti-gay organizations and campaigns stopped being successful, they moved overseas. 2014, the anti-gay law that was passed in Sochi, Russia, it looked familiar to me. So I looked into it, and the person who provided the language for the anti-gay law in Russia was the same person who headed the Oregon Citizens Alliance in the 90s when I was a graduate student at the University of Oregon, and they had a measure put on the ballot that would make it illegal for anyone in a state-funded institution to mention homosexuality without condemning it, the so-called gay propaganda. It was the same person. And we've seen that these campaigns have been taken to various countries in Africa, other parts of the world, and they kind of perfected it. And then we see all of a sudden DeSantis in Florida, the Don't Say Gay, and we say, wow, okay. This is a global phenomenon that's, associated with fascism and conservative gender politics. It's really, very, very concerning. It's supported by oligarchic news empires. So this kind of information is really happening. And one of the things I think that we need to keep in mind is that the right is out organizing us. They're really good at it. They never lose. They understand that if they lose a campaign, they keep going. And it took 50 years to repeal Roe versus Wade. And the target is now on queer and trans people. And by using this focus on children, and having people who really don't have other information going, what do you mean surgery on 7-year-olds? It's not happening. It's not happening. But, you can say it, and you can frighten people, and it's a deliberate tactic to stoke fear. Just you know, to push queer and trans people back out of public life, but also because of larger conservative social and economic agendas.
Jane?
Hi, welcome to the Saskatchewan political moment. Probably not a moment you spend a lot of time in. So here's the important thing you need to know. Currently, the government in Saskatchewan is made up of the Saskatchewan Party. Very creative name. There is a further right-wing party. The Saskatchewan Party is already to the right. There's a further right-wing party called the Saskatchewan United Party. We're going to call them the SUP. So the Sask Party and the SUP. So if you are the leader of the Saskatchewan Party and you have an election coming up next October, let's just say theoretically, because that's when it's scheduled, and you are worried about your voting base leaving your right-wing party for the further right-wing party with a strikingly similar name, one of the things you can do to show that you are really right-wing enough to keep their votes is to punish trans people for existing. And it's really important to pay attention to, it's not actually about the trans people, it is about satisfying the right-wing Christian votes. There is no compassion or care for the trans people in this moment, but it is very much, how do we protect the right-wing voter base? How do we signal to them we're on your side? In this, I'm talking as if I'm the Saskatchewan Party, which I'm not, but like, just bear with me for a moment. But I think it's really important we see this as what it is, which is a signaling we're going to pay attention to Christian values. And I'm going to circle back to agency for a moment. If you are a right-wing Christian, and particularly if you're a right-wing Christian man, you're probably white, and your power comes from being able to say, I know how this works. Men go out and make money. Women stay home and have babies. My children will dress the way they should, and they will have more babies, and then we'll take over the school board so that we can have what we want happening in schools happen in schools. That last part really is happening at about that speed. When you say, actually, people have agency and rights and ability to define themselves and put forward who they are in the world, you're challenging that entire structure of domination, which is why they are interested in saying not possible or making it not possible. I want us to get really comfortable with challenging right-wing Christian patriarchy, right? Because it makes more possibilities for more people, and to name it what it is.
I think it's also important because conservative parties are anti-immigrant, they're anti-indigenous, they're anti-women, etc. And by stoking fear among, say, new immigrant populations, for example, not only do they reinforce the racist notion that, you know, white people are progressive and, you know, people of color are conservative, which has no basis in reality, but they also obfuscate the fact that they actually are not going to represent the interests of those communities. And it's really important for people to understand that. Whereas, you know, I think in terms of the communities that I work in allyship with, they're far more diverse.
How then do you, politics is interwoven into all of this, but how do you, just keeping in mind what you said, you know, the parent and the teacher, I just want to bring it back to the school. I know we have a lot of educators in our audience. How do you cross the political spectrum? How does everybody just, you know, come to this table knowing that you have the child's best interest at heart and address those concerns wherever they may come from across that political spectrum?
So I'm thinking about the classroom and that immediate moment. And I want to say the teacher's job is to create safety in the classroom for all of the students. And so it is all of the students that they are respected, that they are safe, that they feel cared for. And I want us to pay attention to those words because they are not, and that my beliefs are enforced on everyone else. And that's a really important difference. So you can have beliefs I don't agree with, and I can still respect you and make safety for you in my classroom. And that's important. We are also trying to create spaces and classrooms that recognize whoever's in the room is going to engage in a more diverse world with more people and more possibilities than are present in that classroom right now. And how do we help them be ready to make friends, connections, relationships, have employment with people who are different from all the people they've already met?
Victoria, that seems like something that exactly you've been thinking about, right? These are children who are going to grow up and go off into the world.
Yeah, right. And so it's important for us, you know, like Jay says, to really think about how we teach them safety, how we teach them to treat one another. Because we know that schools can be damaging, right? We know kids can be bullies. Sometimes teachers can be bullies. And so it's important for us to think through how are we teaching them how to treat other people as well as themselves. And especially if we're teaching that people who are trans or people who are LGBTQ or any type of difference is not welcome, then that also is traumatizing. There's so much psychological harm that trans people have to overcome. And so if we continue to push this narrative, we continue to pass these laws, we're also going to be dealing with a lot of psychological harm, a lot of trauma that's going to also interfere with how they can be in society. And so it's easy for people to say, well, trans people are maybe not contributing or trans people are not working or being good citizens, but that's because you've traumatized them so much. How can they? Right? And if so that if that's what people are so-called worried about, whether or not these particular individuals are going to function in society, they'll function much better without that psychological trauma that they're kind of taking in right now.
Just one last question. I know you want to address resources and tools for our audience as well. Is there anything you'd like to put forward that people can look up?
I'm going to point back at the ARC Foundation and the SOGI123 folks who have extensive materials available on their website. I'm going to point at the Public Health Agency of Canada, who has resources around gender diversity in schools and sexual diversity in schools in both French and English that are available for PDF downloads right away. I'm going to point out librarians, and I want to give particular credit to librarians who are doing incredible work to make 2S LGBTQ collections available to young people. Which feels particularly important in this moment, again, in terms of where do you get access to information when home and school don't feel like places you can ask those questions or find those resources. So literally talk to your local librarians is a great move. Many teachers' unions across the country have resources, so whatever the teachers' union is where you are is a good place to look. And the reason that all of these professional organizations have resources is because this is, again, upholding professional ethics and the Human Rights Code. And I want to really resist the idea that this is radical work. Like, this is really basic work of respect and inclusion and celebration.
I would encourage people to look for resources that are supportive of trans kids, that tell the stories of trans kids. Because in my experience, I've been asked to, for example, sit on the EDI committee of the BC Soccer Association. I've talked to sporting organizations, and I've talked to school boards. I've talked to a lot of different groups. And when I tell stories about the kids that I've interviewed, it's a game changer. I think that, you know, as Jay said, if we were really thinking what is best for kids, and we asked kids who are gender nonconforming or trans, non-binary, what you would need, you would hear that SOGI education is really important, and you would hear about how incredibly great it is when people support you and believe in you and you can be yourself. And often they'll have stories of before versus after, and you know, their parents are saying, you know, I was really worried, I was scared to death. And, you know, once they came out, they got so much support. It was amazing. I didn't expect it. And, you know, they're doing really, really, really well. So, you know, as Victoria emphasized, save them from trauma. You know, really right now, I think that the Alberta policy is saying better a dead trans kid than a living trans kid, because that kind of policy is, you know, I hate to do it. You know, I don't want to just talk about trans kids in terms of, you know, self-harm and violence against them and discrimination, because they're fabulous and they have so many exciting things to share with us. But this is just a reality that these kinds of policies will actually kill kids. And their parents are, you know, going to be devastated. So let's give them the support that they need so that they can support their kids.
Did you want to add to that?
As far as resources, I mean, I know people, especially now, try to stay out of politics. But please know who your politicians are. Please look at them, see what they are pushing, and really ask yourself, is this the person I want to re-vote for? Especially in local governments. Local governments have so much more power than people think. So who are the people who are making decisions about the Board of Education? Who are the people who are making decisions about what type of books are going to be in our libraries? So if you could just look up where you are, figure out who are those people, whether you vote or not, just figure out who is the person that is making choices for you. And if you want that person, or if you trust that person, because we do have means to change it. But if we don't know who these people are, then we wake up one morning and then we have these bills passed and we're like, who is this Danielle Smith? I don't know. Let me look her up. Right. And she's been there the entire time. So I think it's up to us to know who are the people who are making choices on our everyday lives.
Thank you very much. And we do have some questions now. And I will start with one question from online. I'm not hearing the misinformation regarding SOGI or parental rights. I'm hearing mostly personal stories and opinion. What is the misinformation that is out there? And what do you say to clear it up?
Well, let me touch on the misinformation about SOGI. You know, the accusation that SOGI is turning kids queer and trans. I don't know about any other adult in this room who has interacted with children, but trying to get them to be or do something that is not really who they are is incredibly difficult. Like, I just think about my daughter in her room, for example, you know, trying to get her to behave the way that I want to. There are always going to be queer and trans people. There have always been queer and trans people. The misinformation is that it is SOGI that is creating queer and trans kids. In reality, SOGI policies make school and society less hellish for queer and trans kids. So the decision is, how do you want queer and trans people of all ages to be treated? Not whether or not we can alter our institutional fabric to produce more or less of them.
How do you clear up what is the misinformation, and what do you say to clear it?
So I actually want to say that it's not my job to spread the misinformation. I don't want to give the misinformation airtime, so I want to actually give the facts airtime. I want to say things like, you can do work around sexual orientation and gender diversity with children of all ages. You can create inclusive, safe classrooms for children of all ages. And so I want us to think about these conversations in kindergarten. And the misinformation is what's happening. And what's actually happening is we're saying there's many ways to be a girl. There's many ways to be a boy. There's many ways to be both. There's many ways to be neither. You're going to figure out what's right for you. And we're going to follow your lead. That's the messaging. The messaging is things like, your body belongs to you, and you get to make choices about your body, except in moments of safety. So we're teaching people that they can say no to having other people touch them. We're teaching people that they need to check in before they touch someone else. That's, again, what's happening with young children. Again, we've talked a lot about how parents and teachers can work together. That's combating misinformation, because we're saying parents and teachers, both functioning from what is in the best interest of the child, working together is what's actually happening. We are saying that schools want to be safe places and want to also be hubs for families to come together. And again, I'm going to say this pushes back on the misinformation because it says what's really there. There's a lot of name calling in the misinformation and a lot of fear mongering. We've also said things like, surgery is not happening for young children, because it's not. And so some of the pushing back on misinformation, and I will say that I had to explain hormonal blockers to a group of people last night because Danielle Smith, who is not a medical doctor, does not understand hormonal blockers. And so her talking about it, hormonal blockers as permanent changes, gives people incorrect information. So to be able to talk about hormonal blockers as putting puberty on pause, it's not actually making changes, it's preventing changes. And so I want us to think about a pause as not introducing something new, but as stopping something new from happening. And with blockers in particular, a technology that was created for children who are not trans, but who are experiencing precocious puberty, and that's why this is available, really, the idea that this is creating permanent changes is completely false. The misinformation is really circulating. The information and the facts, which I'm hearing across the panel, is the pushback. And I would also say that I think a lot of what we're hearing is research. It's not just stories, and it's not just personal opinions. These are experiences and understandings of broad groups. And part of what's happening right now is government saying, we don't need to consult. We don't need to talk to trans people, because, like, gosh, what might they say? Or if you're in Saskatchewan, the government's saying, we've consulted. And then the Freedom of Information saying, well, actually, we got 11 letters from parents. So that was our consultation. So I think it's also important to say the reason all of these professional organizations, the independent First Nations, all kinds of groups are saying these policies are dangerous, the ones that are harming trans kids, is because it's harmful. Like,
Alberta's a minister in Alberta was saying that they would go on into some consultation following Danielle Smith's announcement. Where do you see that going? Consultation with trans representatives and advocates.
I would love a policy cycle where we begin with consultation rather than begin with policy. So if we started with consultation, and consultation that's about what do you need, what is going to support your life, that would be excellent. And what I really wanted to think about in terms of consultation is how are we making sure the people most impacted are the ones whose voices are being heard?
Victoria, any thoughts on misinformation?
Yeah. So I think as far as thinking about misinformation, one thing I can say is that a policy that a teacher has to tell a parent that their kid wants to change their pronouns, that's not going to stop them from being trans. Mm-hmm. So it's like, what is really the policy for? Because the policy's not going to stop trans kids from being trans. So there's this misinformation that if a parent knows that they could, in some ways, prevent their kid from being who they are, right? You may care for a couple years, right? But they're going to do what all the other queer kids do. They're going to pack their bags. They're going to move to the big city. And so I think what's misinformation is that parents are losing their children. But what it really is you don't see your child. Your child was always there. But you think you're losing your child because they don't fit whatever dream you had when they were born. And I think all parents have to go through that, regardless if their kid is queer, regardless if their kid maybe wants to move away because they don't think America's the greatest country in the world, right? I think we all as parents have to deal with the fact that our kids are going to one day be adults. And no matter how hard we think it is, their process of changing and growing was always going to be that process. They were always going to be that person. And just because they learned this when they were 12 or 5, we know a lot of people transition when they're older. So teaching them at 5 doesn't matter. We teach these people at 20. People who learned at 20, they transition. So getting the information earlier or later is not changing anything. And so maybe they're afraid their kids can't handle it. But in reality, they can't handle it. So mm-hmm. I think the misinformation is that you guys can't handle this because your kids can. Kids can handle a lot more than we think they can. They usually can't handle it if they realize their parents can't handle it.
That is it for our questions. I know we have still so many coming in. Thank you for all of them. It sounds like you're going to have to do another one of these, Travers. And I welcome back to the podium, Travers.
Thank you so much, Michelle. I want to thank Victoria and Jay, as well as Michelle, for all their important contributions. Thank you again to SFU Public Square for making this event feel to us easy and fabulous. I know a lot of work goes behind that. But mostly what I want to do is thank each and every one of you, both in the room and online. Thank you